And I think one thing that also gives me optimism and hope, but I'm a very big optimist, so it's not hard, is, you know, just watching health and well-being have a place in this conversation around the future of wildland fire too.
This is the Wildfire Lessons Podcast. Our goal is to promote learning by revealing the complexity and risk in the wildland fire environment. We share the lessons. The learning that follows is up to you. Hi, I'm Kelly Woods, Director of the Wildland Fire Lessons Learned Center. On today's episode of the podcast, Wildland Fire Lessons Learned Center Field Operations Specialist Eric Applin visits with Aaron Phelps and Kat DeBose to talk about wildland fire presumptive illness legislation. They also discuss some lessons associated with filing a cancer-related claim with the Department of Labor's Office of Workers' Compensation Programs, or OWCP, and firefighter exposure to environmental hazards. Aaron is the Assistant Director of Doctrine, Learning, and Risk Management for the U.S. Forest Service. Kat is the Wildland Firefighter Health and Well-being Program Coordinator for the Department of the Interior's Office of Wildland Fire. Aaron and Kat define what presumptive illness means for wildland firefighters and share their insights on when someone should file a claim, how and when additional illnesses may be added to the list, and what the agencies are doing to address wildland firefighter health and well-being. I'm excited to get some of this information out. I appreciate Eric, Aaron, and Kat for capturing this conversation. I hope you find value in it too.
I'm very pleased to be joined today by Aaron Phelps and Kat DeBose to talk about cancer among wildland firefighters and the concept of presumptive illness for wildland firefighters. Kat and Aaron, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Likewise.
So to start off with, can you tell us briefly who you are and why this is an important topic for you?
Yeah, this is Kat. I began examining smoke exposure as a graduate student at UC Berkeley, working with the Sierra and Sequoia National Forest. My dissertation research examines exposure to polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So that's a component of smoke that's a known carcinogen. And I wanted to understand what those exposures were like, both on the fire line, but also in fire camps, kind of looking at that off-duty potential for exposure. So through that work, I got involved with the Forest Service Technology and Development Program, and I got to travel all over the Western US measuring smoke across a variety of incidents and really trying to understand the work environment and our exposures. So using that data, did a kind of first stab at estimating the long-term risk for lung cancer and cardiovascular disease. Then in 2019, I served as a crew member on Redmond Hotshots just to gain a deeper understanding of the fire environment. And then from 2019 to 2022, I worked for the CDC, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and I was a lead researcher looking at wildland firefighter safety and health. And then at the end of 2022, I joined the Department of the Interior Office of Wildland Firefighter as the Wildland Firefighter Health and Well-being Program Coordinator. So this topic is really interesting for me, and it's a core of my work and really trying to weave together my research experience as well as that experience that I've been able to have out on the fire line and really trying to understand and prevent health risks.
That's great. Thanks. Aaron?
Yeah, so I have a different track than Kat. So I started off in wildland fire with the BLM for a couple summers while I was going to school, and then transitioned to the Forest Service in 2005 and worked on three different hotshot crews in the southwestern region, and stayed in fire long enough to see some of the, I guess, variety of landscapes that you can work in and the variety of like environments and exposures you could be, I guess, exposed to. And went into more of the environmental policy side out of fire and started doing more of the like analysis at a landscape scale of effects of what we're doing on the landscape of land management treatments, et cetera. And so that sparked my interest in just what we do as a land management organization outside of the actual implementation of like wildland fire, prescribed fire. And then in 2015, I transitioned over into a district ranger role. And that's where kind of that longer term effect of what we're asking folks to do started becoming a little bit more apparent to me, or at least a spark in my mind of like, what is it that we're doing here? I was up on the Lolo National Forest for about 3 years And that valley constantly gets socked in with smoke, whether it was from the Lolo or even Montana or California, it just always gets smoky. And so especially in some of our bigger fire seasons, just having fire camps located in smoke because there's no other opportunities to put them elsewhere, and thinking through, you know, not just the effects to public, but the firefighters who are kind of living and breathing in that as they move through the season in different parts of the country too. And as I've kind of moved along in my career, I was a district ranger in Idaho, also on the Payette. So similar kind of just growth of seeing where smoke goes, what are we doing with our folks? And then some of the firefighters that I was originally on a cruise with started coming down with some pretty severe health issues. My former superintendent on Flagstaff had a variety of really severe kidney issues and health issues, and just thinking like there's got to be, I mean, this has to be tied to the work he was doing. He's been a hotshot for the majority of his life. And then like one after another, just having like really serious diseases and cancers come up one after the other. It's kind of glaring in the face of like, this has to be connected with the work that we're doing on the landscape. And so when I had the opportunity to move into a branch chief role with the Forest Service National Office under risk management, I took it because I really was interested in being able to focus attention and energy on some of these risks, both short and long term, for firefighters. And then I'm currently the assistant director for doctorate learning and risk management for the fire and aviation management for the Forest Service. And I get the opportunity to help lead some of these program development conversations, you know, that we're going to talk about today. And it's just really a passion for me because coming from like the implementation side of it to the planning and decision making side of it, and then now kind of at more the national policy and, you know, program development side, there's just so much that we don't know, and then so much that we do know, but a lot that I think we still don't know. So it's a really exciting time to have a place at the table to think through how do we start addressing these really, really complex issues and think through how to best manage and maybe change a system to take care of our folks while still being land management agencies.
Yeah, right on. Thanks for that. Yeah, I think it's interesting how you both kind of came to this in slightly different ways, but I think we all, you know, or at least many of us see what you described, Aaron, come up, you know, among people that we know through our careers. I know I worked with someone who developed brain cancer, someone who was very, very prodigious prescribed burner, that, you know, I think at the time everyone assumed it was related to the work that she was doing, but that was more than 10 years ago, I believe. So kind of before the era that we're in right now. But yeah, I really appreciate that. So I think we can get it started then about this topic itself. I think to start with, can we just talk about the legislation that brought about presumptive illness coverage for federal wildland firefighters?
Sure. And there's a lot of history to this too that we probably won't go into here, but there is a RLS on the Lessons Learned Center website too that does do a good job of highlighting some of the other related stuff, like some of the FICA bulletins from 2022 and 2023 that kind of dive deeper into the topic of wildland firefighter exposure and diseases. So explicitly about the presumptive illness side of things, in 2023, actually it was late 2022 in December, Congress passed the fiscal year 23 National Defense Authorization Act. We usually refer to it as NDAA because it's a little bit less of a mouthful. But there's a section in that act called Fairness for Federal Firefighters. And that was really kind of the groundbreaking act to really put a bunch of different things in play. One of the big ones is it created this list of presumed illnesses for federal employees in fire protection activities. So we can kind of go over those too, but it is a list of cancers and some long-term illnesses that Congress basically said, if you meet this definition of a firefighter an employee in fire protective activities, it's going to be presumed that if you are diagnosed with these cancers or illnesses, it is because of your job. And that's huge, like the burden of proof to prove that they're connected to something that you did in performance of your duties is gone. It's just basically you have to, you know, show proof that you meet their definition of the employee and fire protection activities. So that was one part of the act. And then the other part that I want to mention too, because it's a big part of what Kat and I are working on with a lot of others, is Congress directed the Department of Interior and Department of Agriculture to conduct basically a long-term health study to dive deeper into the exposures that were a part of the wildland fire environment and a plan for how to track those exposures and then also inform potentially new illnesses being added to the list. So kind of a more comprehensive look at what we're doing with our employees and how we're managing those exposures.
Yeah, and just to add to, you know, it does define a firefighter as someone who is trained in fire prevention, has the legal authority and responsibility to engage in fire suppression, is engaged in the prevention, control, or extinguishment of fires or response to emergency situations, and performs these duties as a primary responsibility of their job. And I think the other interesting piece to this and ties back to some of the direction out of the bipartisan infrastructure law is also to develop prevention strategies for exposures in our environment and make those recommendations back to Congress.
So one more thing to just add in here too, and we might be trying to get to it in a later question, but it doesn't require that you are currently a firefighter. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good distinguishment to make. The only real timestamp it has on it beyond what Kat read too is if the employee is diagnosed with that illness or disease not later than 10 years after the last active date of employment as an employee in fire protection activities. So this does also pertain to folks who are no longer working for the federal government or maybe no longer in a kind of primary fire position or active in the fire environment. So retirees or folks that have moved on with their careers as well.
Gotcha. But within a time window then, though.
Right.
And while we're on this kind of background, I guess, right now, do either of you know about, you know, presumptive illness in realms outside the federal government? You know, like, say, for states or local municipalities or counties, like, where are they on this?
It does vary from state to state on which illnesses they do cover and what requirements you need to meet for that. We're not totally sure how this effort relates to those individual state ones.
Yeah, right. No, I understand. It seems to be kind of a hodgepodge from place to place. I was just wondering how that, yeah, where they are in relationship to the feds, I guess. So, Aaron, you mentioned this list of diseases and illnesses that are presumed to be caused by employment as a fire protection employee, right? I looked at that list about, it was probably close to a year ago, and it's definitely, I'd say, once you look at it for more than a second, it's pretty glaring that there are some cancers that are covered and there are some cancers that are not, or at least that are not listed on that initial list. So in particular, there's a lot of like women's reproductive cancers that are not on that list. So because they're not on the list, does that mean that they're not covered by this presumptive illness?
So just because they're not on the list doesn't mean that somebody shouldn't submit a case with OWCP, because that's part of kind of this, the next iteration is Congress recognized that this wasn't potentially an all-inclusive list, but it was based on existing research and data. Even for some of that research that really pulled in more from the structure side. So Congress recognized, I think, early on that there would be a need to continuously reevaluate this list and add to it as we learned more, because you're right, like the glaringly obvious ones are the women's reproductive health. And so I think Kat can help me with this one as well, but the intent is that, and actually the act itself directs the Department of Labor Secretary to reevaluate the list, I think it's annually, and determine based on new science or research or data what needs to be added to the list. And so there is an opportunity, and it is actually like kind of a requirement to make sure that we are continually assessing and feeding in information for that effort based on what we're learning from our side as well. And so I think my biggest plug there is if you or someone you know, or even a loved one who's passed away, has or suffered from an illness that's not on that list, don't not submit a claim. I think the door is more open because of this act. And so it also helps us to kind of track what else is out there in the system too.
Yeah, and just to add to that, one of the pieces that was called out within the NDAA was that within 3 years of an enactment, it was to evaluate the best scientific evidence for development of many of those reproductive cancers, as well as rhabdomyolysis. Mm-hmm. And also that anyone can petition the Department of Labor to include a disease under this Fairness for Federal Firefighters.
Gotcha. So that 3 years would be, you said it was enacted at the end of 22, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, right on. So next year, end of next year. Okay, cool. Thanks for that. So then, do either of you have a sense of how many wildland firefighters have submitted presumptive illness claims?
So that's a really good question. Based on what we know currently, we think there's been about 30 claims submitted, both from Interior and the Forest Service, and different kind of stages. So it's a little bit hard to nail down an exact answer at this point, because there's always the potential that somebody filed a claim kind of like not through our systems, more through like the e-comp system as well. But I can say that the claims entered for the Forest Service side do include a mix from current employees, former employees, retirees, and survivors on behalf of deceased Forest Service wildland firefighters. So that may not seem like a large number, but for the first year, I think we're trying to get the word out. And that's why this podcast is really helpful, too, to make sure that folks understand that this is a new thing and that it's available for folks.
Gotcha. So when should someone consider filing a claim with? So it is ultimately like this is through the Office of Workers' Compensation Program, right?
Yes. And so, you know, ultimately it is the Department of Labor, OWCP, Office of Workers' Compensation Program that will assess each case and determine, you know, is it meet the definition and, you know, like work through all the data. I mean, that's way outside of my experience and stuff too, but they're the ones that really assess each case. And so both Interior and the Forest Service, we have, you know, HR or Human Resources Workers' Compensation offices to assist our employees with the filing of paperwork and just the understanding of the process as well. But we don't get into the vetting of each case. It's more of a support kind of function too. And so we really tier to a Department of Labor OWCP fact sheet that's linked on their website. And it really helps. It says it's like OWCP fact sheet for Fairness for Federal Firefighters. And it's really helpful for folks, I think, to assess, is it worth it for me to submit a claim? How am I best square this up to make sure that I've got what I need to submit a claim? What are the things that I should be working with my supervisor to make sure is part of the documentation process, et cetera. And so I'd say for folks getting familiar with that fact sheet and just some of the OWCP resources, but also, like we mentioned earlier too, even if your cancer illness isn't on the list or you're not quite sure if you meet the definition, we're encouraging people to not kind of hold that back, to still move forward with claims if they feel like that's the best thing for them and their families. And part of this is the fact that I don't know if a lot of people know too, that Department of Labor, as part of one of those FICA bulletins, stood up a separate kind of claims unit specialized and focused on firefighters. And that's really expedited the process way beyond kind of the typical OWCP claims adjudication process. So when we last met with Department of Labor, they had mentioned, and kind of just a quick look at their data, that the typical processing time for claims under that special unit was basically 50% faster than the normal claims process, which is a big deal. And that's including like outliers that are longer and then some shorter. Mm-hmm. And so we have heard some reports, like we had a Forest Service retiree who had been retired for about 5 years and submitted a claim of one of the illnesses on the list and had his case adjudicated within 10 days.
Oh my gosh.
So it is a different process than what folks may have experienced even like 2 years ago.
Yeah, that is substantially different. Wow, that's impressive. Kat, do you have anything to add on that question at all?
No, I don't. Aaron is well-versed in this topic.
Right on. Well, I have kind of an ignorant question, I guess, to go along with that. When should you file a claim? Which is that, you know, say I went to the dermatologist and they discovered that I had skin cancer, something like that. You know, before this, I would have immediately just used my personal insurance that I have, you know, through my employer, right, through the federal government, and would have paid a copay for sure. I don't know what percentage that would have ended up being. I don't, you know, obviously it depends on how much treatment, that kind of thing. Could potentially end up being some money, but insurance would take most of that. So how is that? What's the advantage, I guess, of doing it this way, of going through OWCP, of filing a claim, whereas before you probably just would have, you know, gone to your doctor and then filed through your insurance?
So I think maybe two things from my perspective. One is that it does take some of the burden off your private insurance to cover these claims when, you know, Congress has said this is something that you obtain because you're working on behalf of, you know, Wildland Fire Protective Services. So I think it puts the bill more firmly where it needs to be. And part of that is also it helps us with our data in a way. And that sounds a little bit cold, but we don't know what we don't know at this point, mm-hmm. too. And, you know, I mentioned a long-term health study that also the act also is directing us to do. But right now, the data set is kind of the OWCP claims process a bit as well. And so, you know, it's not just who's getting sick, but it's also helping us show the cost, the long-term cost of what it is that we're asking folks to do, not just on an individual, like personal level, but also the fiscal cost of this. Because the OWCP costs are not going to be the same that they were in previous years because of this. And it's just helpful to understand through data like that, what kind of system we need, because mitigations are not going to be inexpensive, or I don't think easy, as we learn more about what might be effective in helping minimize the chance of some of these long-term illnesses. We'll never not respond to wildland fires, mm-hmm. but there are some things that we could probably implement to help lessen the risk of these longer-term illnesses and cancers.
And I think that's the other thing to think about it too, is the long-term piece and like kind of the lifetime piece of it mm-hmm. too. It may not be a big cost now, but providing that coverage for a longer term.
Gotcha, I appreciate that. So then with the, so far with folks who have filed claims, have you seen any lessons that are out there from people that have gone through this process, or lessons that people should be aware of to kind of navigate this system?
So we've been trying to meet quarterly, Interior and Forest Service and Department of Labor, OWCP, to kind of ask that question, like what is everybody seeing from their seat, and is there anything that would be helpful to make sure that we address differently or, you know, change? And so I think it's really been a team effort on identifying things that could help ease the system. So that being said, we're still fairly early, I think, in processing this new act and this new system. So some of the things, like I mentioned earlier, that OWCP fact sheet, we have found that a lot of the questions that we're getting or some of the issues, at least early on as case managers or working with potential claimants or claimants, is if they would have seen that fact sheet, or if we would have provided it earlier, that might have helped them know, you know, what's right for them, and also how to prepare. Do they meet the definition? If they're not in a primary position and they've been more in a support role for a number of years, you know, that still doesn't mean they're not eligible, but they just have to have a little bit of different documentation. Mm-hmm. So how to kind of set them up for success. And obviously if folks are currently ill, or even if they've recovered, or if it's their family that are filing on their behalf, it's good to have these conversations earlier rather than later, I guess. So, so folks have some time to think through how to get things squared away. If you're undergoing cancer treatments, for example, it is an extra burden to think through how do I provide this documentation. So that's why we're trying to get the word out earlier rather than waiting until people are sick, is just increase awareness, have people think through, you know, the Forest Service, you know, speaking for the Forest Service, I know it's probably the same on the interior. Our case managers are really, really active, and they want to do the best that they can for our employees too, both current and former, and their families. And so they really are a good resource to reach out to early on to help navigate the system and think through how best to approach each individual case, because everybody's case is really mm-hmm. unique. And I think it's hard to draw really general, helpful tips because everything that we've seen so far across those 30-ish cases has been very unique.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think, you know, I think with what you described about, you know, there being a special unit for wildland firefighters for those claims and then those processing times, you know, hopefully people can, you know, hopefully people don't feel like there's a barrier to filing these and can just jump in and do that, knowing that, you know, hopefully that process isn't too onerous for them, because it doesn't sound like so far that process really has been too bad. Like it's kind of off to a good start, more or less, right?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest thing is really that presumptive piece of it, the fact that the burden of proof that, you know, you have to tie this to a specific CA1 or CA2 mm-hmm. in your past, you know, like this fire is where I was exposed to this toxin. Like that's not part of it anymore. I think that is a huge, huge deal. So, you know, the bigger burden of proof is more of the aligning the treatments and kind of working with the Department of Labor on, you know, like how to work through each individual case. And then just, you know, for some people, it's probably a little bit different if you're, you know, still firmly in the position, or you were very easily able to prove that you meet the definition, like Kat read off earlier. That's a pretty low burden. If you are more of a support function, like a militia that goes out continuously, you know, there's a little bit of a higher burden just to track down IQCS records, but it's still not insurmountable. I don't think. It seems like it's a little bit of a lower bar to make sure that you meet that definition in terms of being eligible for this as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think everybody's learning right as we go. So it's one of those things that it's, like I mentioned, every case is really unique, but we have seen folks submit claims for cancers or long-term illnesses that they've already recovered mm-hmm. from, you know, like years later down the road, folks that are currently still in, you know, in treatment or facing treatment. So like you mentioned earlier, you know, I've been diagnosed, I know this is coming, you know, submitting a claim and just getting that ball rolling. And then like we mentioned too, in the unfortunate circumstance when a survivor or family member needs to submit a claim to make sure that they get compensated for the treatment or and all the costs associated with suffering from one of those illnesses too.
Right. So then you talked about the speed that these claims are being accepted has increased 50%, right, on average so far. But what about the actual, like how long has it been taking, to your knowledge, for the benefits to actually begin once that claim is accepted?
So that is more in Department of Labor's wheelhouse, but what we've seen is that once a claim is accepted, it may take up to 1 to 2 weeks from the date approved for the monthly compensation benefits to be paid out to the claimant or survivors.
Okay. Yeah, great. Okay, so moving on a little bit, I guess from that particular piece of it, another thing that we've been talking about as well is kind of a little bit of like prevention and knowledge about the prevalence of cancer in wildland firefighters. I understand that some fire departments have cancer screening as part of their annual wellness exam. Is that something that wildland fire agencies are talking about doing? Are there barriers to instituting that?
Yeah, so like Aaron mentioned, part of the NDAA was to conduct that comprehensive study. So what we're doing to really meet that task is working to develop both DOI and Forest Service together, working to develop a medical surveillance program that will include an assessment of employees who are exposed or potentially exposed to the occupational hazards in our work environment, but really gearing towards the ones that were called out in NDAA, which is fire, smoke, and toxic fumes. This will be a voluntary program, but we hope that it will give folks timely information about their health status in addition to the surveillance and monitoring effort, we'll provide information to everyone on the hazards and health outcomes that occur in our work environment, as well as, like I said, with the prevention efforts, make those recommendations back in Congress. But one of those, like you mentioned, the cancer screening, we are exploring options to make that part of the direction out of NDAA. And right now, like I said, we see screening for cancer to be an optional component. We're hoping to really leverage our medical standards exam to provide the surveillance component as well. The current recommended screenings that are out there, really looking at firefighters in particular, include cancer screenings for lung, skin, breast, cervix, testes, prostate, thyroid, oral cancer, bladder, and colon cancer. We're also exploring newly available multi-cancer early detection tests. So this is just taking some blood that some structure municipal departments are starting to use to really give their folks early information about potential development of cancer. So one of the barriers to implementing this is cost for everyone. So we're using the support that we have from this legislative effort to expanding all facets of firefighter health and well-being. And so we hope to be able to evaluate these options to improve efforts to understand health risks and to reduce risk as well.
Gotcha. Thanks, Kat. What about efforts for understanding like long-term health for wildland firefighters? If there's anything more, did you cover it, kind of talking about that last piece?
So part of what Interior and Forest Service are working together on is what we're calling the Federal Wildland Firefighter Health and Wellbeing Program. And this is tied to the NDAA, like we've been talking about today, and it's also tied to the bipartisan infrastructure law, which directed us to do certain things around behavioral health, specifically PTSD, for our wildland firefighters, and then also do, exposure assessments as well. So there's some overlap there with what we are doing with the NDAA as well. And so part of the reason I bring this up is because we've recognized that we can't kind of put these different issues or health components of firefighters into different buckets and keep them separate. There's a lot of overlap. You can't really talk about behavioral health without also acknowledging some of the physical and environmental health of our folks too. And then you can't talk about cancer and long-term illnesses and ignore the mental strain of both those who are undergoing treatments or might be fearful of contracting some of those diseases, but also, you know, the survivors, just that ripple effect throughout a community when we have somebody who is sick in our community too. So there's a lot of overlap there. And that's one of the, I think, really neat things about what we're doing with the Forest Service and Interior is looking at these things collectively and seeing where do we need to make sure we are in lockstep and going through this either like a joint, like one kind of portal versus like just making sure that we are setting up mirrored systems so that we are able to report out very consistently. And also at the end of the day, making sure that our wildland firefighters on the ground don't get caught in kind of like this unnecessary bureaucracy, that just because you're a BLM firefighter, it doesn't mean that you're gonna have a completely different service or system than a Forest Service firefighter. And that's fairly new, I think, to both of us. So that's part of what I wanted to mention today is that we are taking a holistic look at what are we doing with our wildland firefighters. The long-term health effects under NDAA are more focused on the physical environment from the environment, but there is also this long-term mental health issues that are caused from the occupation as well that we're assessing and determining the best way to set up a system to manage those as well.
Right on. And then obviously, you know, if somebody works for the Forest Service versus the BLM versus, you know, the National Park Service, maybe some of those processes are going to be a little bit different on the administrative side, right? But that's cool to see that there's this kind of joint effort so that what's being offered for people, the actual, you know, whatever, the coverage by the federal government is going to be pretty uniform across all the agencies that do this work for the federal government, right?
Yeah, and that was pretty clear intent from Congress on both bipartisan infrastructure law and also NDAA, I think, with the way that they they worded some of their direction. You know, it didn't call us out individually. It's, you know, you guys will be working on this and you're doing the same thing. So it really behooves us to make sure that we're all coming to the table. And, you know, like even just this podcast example today, like Kat brings a completely different skill set than I do to this conversation. And it's really, I think, a strong team of experts with different experience in different areas to make sure that we're thinking through things and setting up a program that has longevity on both sides, physical and environmental and nice. Behavioral as well.
So on that topic of kind of long-term health and surveillance of long-term health, how does that relate to what the CDC has been doing with this firefighter registry? You know, in doing some prep for this podcast, I followed a link and went to that registry, and I don't know how long it took, maybe a half hour to get myself enrolled in that and ask some interesting questions, some demographic stuff, and then a bunch of stuff about my career, how long I was a primary firefighter and what kinds of jobs. It was actually kind of fun to do the math and see how many months was I a primary firefighter. So anyway, how does that relate to what you've been talking about?
Yeah, so the NIOSH Firefighter Registry for Cancer predates our work a little bit. So in 2018, Congress passed the Firefighter Cancer Registry Act. So this act directed NIOSH to develop a registry to better understand mm-hmm. the link between firefighting and cancer. So the NFR, as it's commonly called, is the largest effort undertaken so far to understand and reduce cancer risk among all firefighters in the U.S. So all firefighters with or without cancer, no matter their length of service, are eligible to register. And this is really trying to get a large cohort of individuals to get information to allow researchers to better understand the relationship between workplace risk factors and cancer, to better understand those risk factors, to drive and lead and inform prevention efforts that include proper training, proper use of personal protective equipment, healthier lifestyles, kind of all of those facets of health that we look at to reduce our overall health risk. And so all, like I said, current, former firefighters with or without cancer are encouraged to apply. In addition, this is one of the data sources that the Department of Labor can use when evaluating new cancers or illnesses to add, well, new cancers because it's just for cancer, but new cancers to add to that list of covered illnesses.
It was a pretty fascinating little questionnaire to fill out. There was questions about how often did you wash your personal protective equipment? Did you try to take a shower within 24 hours? Within an hour. Yeah. What else was there? Questions about, did you wash your hands before eating? And there were a lot of no's on my part. And so if anything, it was an awareness thing for me about maybe what I need to do in the future. But I appreciate that. And definitely, that was a pretty easy process and, obviously helpful, hopefully for the future. So I definitely encourage people to find that and go register. So, is there anything being done right now to help our wildland firefighters kind of understand exposure, the things that may impact their health that they're encountering on the job, and ways that they can prevent those things?
Yeah, so that's some of the work that we're undertaking. And this also, it's tied to NDAA, but it's definitely tied to the language out of bipartisan infrastructure law as well for the agencies to develop and recommend mitigation strategies for line of duty environmental hazards. So that's some work that has been tasked to NWCG Risk Management Committee. So we'll be releasing some information soon, but it's some of the work that my research has really much focused on since I started this as my career, and really just trying to think about the wildland fire environment is so complex. And I think one really eye-opening thing for me when I was a firefighter is when there are so many risks, how do you mitigate all of them? And in particular for smoke is, how do you mitigate one that can be so ubiquitous in our environment and also so hard to mitigate and manage, yeah. especially when there's all these other competing risks. So I think that's one thing that really has stuck with me as I think about this is how do you reduce cumulative exposure where there's not one easy answer? And so often in the field of occupational health, we tier towards the NIOSH hierarchy of controls, which is used to, it's a framework to mitigate and limit hazards in the workplace. So, you know, we're not going to eliminate the hazard. We're not a chemical manufacturer. We're not going to substitute it for something else. So really where we lie is kind of at the bottom of that framework with administrative controls and really thinking about how we change, how we work, how we go about our day and our tasks to reduce our exposure. And I think about risk in like the super simplistic way of risk is a function of duration and concentration. And anytime I can change one of those variables, I'm reducing risk. And I think that's what's the hardest thing about this is there's not a one size fits all answer. It's gonna be very fire dependent, it's gonna be very operation dependent. So it's really, you know, it's using all of the information that we're trying to give out to folks to inform them on how to reduce those risks and just better inform them about, you know, when do we know that exposures may be higher? When are they lower? So some of the recommendations that have been made in the past are to establish mop-up criteria that allow folks to secure their area based on fire behavior, not necessarily going a so many feet in prescription, rotating folks in and out of areas of unavoidable smoke exposure, which also has its own risks too, because you may have these higher, shorter term exposures as well. One of the tools that incident management teams may use is to use air resource advisors to monitor exposure in camp and inform concerns around line exposure as well as at ICPs, and really trying to think about locating ICPs and spike camps in areas that aren't going to be subject to inversion when practical. You know, all of this is hard. Our environment is incredibly complex. So the other thing that we're trying to learn more about is the dermal exposures that we have in our environment. What does it mean to have ash on your skin all day? And so a recent study out of Canada did show that through internally measured exposure to hydrocarbons for firefighters, those that performed enhanced skin hygiene practices, so washing your hands, did find that they had lower concentrations post kind of skin hygiene, enhanced skin hygiene practices, as opposed to those who did not perform those.
So just to tag on a little bit too, you know, that's part of what I think we're trying to communicate out to the community as well, is that we are just really starting this journey of figuring out what are the specific environmental hazards. I mean, we know what's out there, but like to Kat's point, when does something trip a threshold into a place where we need to do X mitigation immediately, or what's like the decontamination procedures? Like there's all of these things that we just don't have the research or the data on too. And so we're just really starting this journey of understanding and actually like kind of quantifying and measuring and, you know, figuring out what does right look like in the wildland fire environment. And so, you know, the dermal exposure study that she mentioned, that's a really interesting one too, because, you know, we talk about the wildland fire culture a lot in all of our different conversations. You know, what are those barriers to receiving care, whether mental or physical, and you know, what are the barriers or the cultural things that might actually we might be able to leverage to further maybe this education and change in our systems. And that's one of them is you know, I remember you don't necessarily have a trust factor of extremely high with somebody with clean yellow. It's like this thing in the wildland fire environment, you know. And the same thing, like when you walk into fire camp you know, after a shift, being just filthy, you know, shows how hard you've worked. You know, it's like this tie to the ground. And I mean, there's truth to that. Like there's pride. There's a lot of pride in doing hard work. I mean, I think that's what draws a lot of people to wildland firefighting. But we're also trying to show that there's a link potentially to some of these cancers and long-term illnesses. And like Kat mentioned, something as relatively simple as like washing your hands and kind of wiping down, you know, your skin where it has this high level of contact with ash and all these other things in the fire environment, like that can make a difference. That can reduce, or not mitigate, not necessarily like highly reduce, but they can have an effect on what you're being exposed to, I guess, on a daily rate too. So it's not like we're gonna stop there. That's not like, okay, the answer to everything, but it's just something that we're trying to help educate and maybe take a little bit of a shift in a culture about, you know, what it means to be a proud and, you know, established and, I don't know, like wildland fire, what it means to be a wildland firefighter at the end of the day, and also taking care of yourself and taking care of each other and trying to shift something that might not serve the community in the long term.
And I think too, it's thinking about health. You know, we talk a lot about our safety risks, but it's thinking about these risks that we face at, you know, this low level possibly each and every day, but kind of thinking about it through the longevity of our career as well, and thinking about this cumulative effect.
Yeah, I think everybody is invincible early on in your career. You know, it's not just unique to wildland firefighters. I think that's a systemic thing. Yeah, but as we are seeing folks have these illnesses and cancers fairly young too. I mean, it's definitely seems to be younger than the general population. I mean, that's a wake up, and that's I think it's a different kind of lens about viewing, like Kat mentioned, you know, what's worth it and what's maybe not, and how can you take care of yourself in a way that will make you healthier in the long run too. And I wanted to mention that, and Kat can kick me on this too, but the cancer screening part of this that we talked about a little bit earlier too, you know, one of the things that it seems like we're recognizing is these exposures are leading to something that's coming up in our firefighters at a generally a younger age than general population. And so some of the times their private insurance potentially doesn't cover screenings for these illnesses or cancers at a younger age. So, you know, usually those things are dictated by an age that's, you know, reflective of a general population. And so that's also kind of in the back of our minds is, you know, folks, we might, when we decide how to frame up a cancer screening or illness screening, how do we best define when and how often to do those screenings, recognizing that money is always going to be a limiting factor. So how do we best kind of thread that needle of making sure that we're trying to keep an eye on folks, but just for general awareness for folks as well, you know, knowing that what we're setting up is highly likely to remain voluntary, it behooves everybody to talk with their medical providers about whether or not they should get screened for some of these things earlier than maybe a normal, you know, non-firefighter person would.
And I think that's the lens we keep in our minds too, is how to give folks timely information about their health.
I was wondering about the respirators. Do we want to talk about that?
So within the NIOSH hierarchy of controls, kind of the last, not last resort, but last option on there is personal protective equipment, so PPE. And it's the last on there because it's known to be the least effective, and that's mostly due to human error. So right now, you know, we all see structure firefighters wearing those self-contained breathing apparatus, but we don't have that available to us in the wildland environment. Those only work for about an hour, or about 30 minutes to an hour. So, you know, right now there are a lot of folks who are working on this, new technologies. So it continues to be discussed. However, a respirator that meets both NIOSH certification, which is kind of the gold standard and expectation for respirators, as well as meets National Fire Protection Association 1984 standards, which establishes kind of minimum requirements for the function of it, as well as the complex exposures that are in there while performing arduous work. Nothing that meets those kind of two standards is currently available on the market, but there is efforts right now. The Department of Homeland Security has put a lot of funding into the development of a wildland respirator. So it's definitely something that may become available to wildland fire, but is not currently on there right now. So really that's kind of where I tier back to those hierarchy of controls, is where we live within that framework. And the one that is available to us is that administrative control piece, and just trying to think about ways each and every day, each and every operation, that may be an opportunity to reduce exposure. And I think, you know, it's hard. It's hard when you're juggling all of these other decision-making within your operational day, is to think about that. But I do have one example of, I was out on the Six Rivers Lightning Complex recently, a few years ago, and a whole branch director pulled an entire division off for the morning because the inversion was so bad. They couldn't even see what they were doing in there. And with the inversion being so bad, fire activity was very low. It was kind of on the tail end of the fire anyways. But, you know, I went up to him at the end of that day at night briefing and was like, thank you. Thank you for trying something out. And, you know, he kind of was just like, this is my job. This is what I'm supposed to do. But it really kind of struck me as an example of, you know, how you make those daily decisions based on operations, based on tactics to really change someone's exposure profile for that day.
And just to tag on to that a bit too, it seems like this comes up a lot, like Kat mentioned, that, you know, the easy button is, why don't you have a respirator for wildland firefighters? And especially last year when we had all the smoke from Canada floating into the Eastern Seaboard, that came up even more. It's like, holy cow, like, you mean wildland firefighters don't have a respirator that they wear? They just breathe this in all the time. And so a lot of it has been, you know, managing expectations and clarifying and coming to the table as a partner too, that, you know, like, what works in one arena of a firefighter, you know, a structure firefighter, for example, or even like a municipal fire department that might be more close to their truck and closer to a road, et cetera, doesn't work across the board for a wildland firefighter. I mean, like, you think about smoke jumpers and repellers, you know, like being inserted into really remote areas. And then you think about, you know, like hotshot crews or any kind of crew member really that is deployed farther into a fire and doesn't have access to a resupply unit, and it's carrying this extra weight, even if it seems like kind of a minor extra weight on top of their, you know, already on average 45 pound pack. And then you think that the feasibility of that, and then also we have to look at all of the other risks in the environment. So Kat articulated that really well. But one of the things that we try to articulate too is wearing a respirator going to cause more issues too? So for example, we have a firefighter who's working in California and hiking up a steep mountain in, you know, the middle of nowhere up within like 90 degrees temperature. And they were saying they needed to wear a respirator to reach that line because there's some smoke in the area. We know that's not going to help them in the long term with heat exhaustion and some of the other hazards in the wildland fire environment. So where would it make the most sense to deploy a respirator as and if they become available to us, like per all the processes that Kat mentioned? So that's part of what we're trying to think through and come to the table as folks are developing this, is helping them understand the complexities of the wildland fire environment. And that it's not as simple as just saying, okay, we're going to put respirators out on everybody, and that's going to solve this issue of smoke exposure and inhalation hazards. It's not that simple, and we have to make sure that we're not masking a bigger problem potentially with what we think a solution could be with a respirator, and thinking through how would we best deploy that kind of PPE in the right context and managing for those other risks.
And I think at the end of it, you know, what we're trying to do is build the best toolbox with the most tools available. And I would also make a plug for one of those too is training. Training folks on the hazards so that everyone understands, you know, when and where is it a hazard? How can it affect your health? What are some options that are available to reduce risk? And so right now, I definitely think training and education is a big piece of what we're looking at within kind of the larger context for firefighter health and well-being, so that we can empower people with information. One of the videos that we do have available out there, and I'll make a plug for it, is one that was done by George Broyles, I believe in 2013, called Know the Hazards of Smoke. So it's in the WIFSTAR library. So if anyone wants to plug that into their refresher this year and just get kind of a somewhat up-to-date information on, you know, what's in our environment, what do we know, and what are the tools and options that are available to folks to reduce exposure.
Well, I really appreciate that conversation. I mean, I thought a lot, you know, kind of during that, I guess, about different experiences I've had on some fires, and thinking about how, you know, when I was on a hand crew, there was never any time really to take a shower. I took a shower at the end of the assignment, but that was kind of it, because basically taking a shower was taking away time that I could be sleeping. But that changed when I became a field observer. And now all of a sudden I needed to get into camp to give information to the SIT unit. So I was getting into camp a lot earlier. Now I was taking a shower and doing laundry multiple times on fire assignments. I had never experienced that before in my entire fire career. That was really, really kind of revelatory to me what it could be like. But also, you know, if you think about having a fire camp like you're talking about that's down in some deep valley on the Klamath or Six Rivers or in Idaho and some of those, you know, deep holes that exist there, you could move it further out, right, potentially. But now you're adding literally thousands of hours of driving to people, which then is going to eat into that time that they could potentially have at camp to take the shower or to wash their clothes. Like you're talking about, it's just such a difficult question of these, not competing, because they don't really compete, but it's like all of these different risks that all exist at the same time. And there's kind of just that balance is not as simple as I think some people think. And I think in particular, when you talk about things like the respirator you're just talking about, it's easy to think about that if you're living in smoke for a few days during a particularly bad fire season, but you're not having to do that additional pretty arduous work, you know, potentially of running a saw all day or something like that, and trying to do that in a respirator is kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you completely summarized the conundrum that we find ourselves in, and oftentimes when I'm feeling frustrated or just like, how come I can't figure this out? And I just have to remind myself, if it was easy, someone else would have done it already.
Right. Like, well, and I really think that we are really at the cusp of a lot of change within our wildland fire environment. And like Kat mentioned earlier, this education and training and making giving folks the data and information to help make their own decisions. You know, like we're really... I think at the brink of a lot of change in a lot of different ways. You know, there's a lot of things Congress is talking about, you know, that our agencies are talking about around the fire mm-hmm. system in general. And so I think all of these things are playing into what does right look like and what should our future look like. And I firmly believe that, you know, even maybe 5 years down the road, we'll look at what folks are doing and it's gonna be different than how folks are operating today for the better. And like you mentioned, Eric, I think some of that is, you know, it's always been off the table if you're, or like not always, but it seems like generally like in culture and in practices, it's off the table to always go back into fire camp and take a shower and do your laundry. But that doesn't mean it has to be that way in the future. Like what can we set up to maybe reduce some of those barriers to doing things that could actually be really effective mitigations for people's long-term and short-term health? And so that's not going to happen overnight because we can't just do a management control and expect everybody to buy in and have the systems in place, you know, like even just at a really functional and kind of tactical level, you know, like right. enough laundry right. systems out there to be at every ICP. Like that's not feasible right now. But like, what are some of the things that we could implement? And like Kat mentioned, just increasing the awareness and then the tools for folks to be able to make a difference, you know, both at an individual level, at an IMT and an agency administrator level, and then kind of across the wildland fire system in general too.
And I think one thing that also gives me optimism and hope, but I'm a very big optimist, so it's not hard, is, you know, just watching health and well-being mm-hmm. have a place in this conversation around the future of wildland fire too. Mm-hmm. In the Wildfire Commission, you know, there are a handful of recommendations all through that report that really focus on firefighter health and well-being. So I would say it's not just stopping at Bill and NDAA as well. It's really being weaved into how we think about the future of fire.
That's really great to hear that. I really appreciate that. I think as far as, you know, any questions that I had here, we've gone through that, had a really, in my opinion, illuminating conversation, at least for me. But before we sign off, do you, either of you have any other thoughts or any other messages that you'd like to share?
I'd say if we can make a plug to everybody in the wildland fire environment, including those folks who are currently actively engaged and folks who are retired and maybe in different positions now, is to, this is gonna sound cheesy, mm-hmm. but to have hope that a lot of the things that have been daylighted and kind of known at a ground level, or at least maybe like sensed at a ground level, are being made more aware. Like Kat mentioned, that these are firefighter health and well-being, or the health and well-being of our like wildland fire culture in particular, is a part of a lot of conversations across the board. And it is a, you know, something that is supported, I would say up and down the chain, definitely within the Forest Service, and I'm speaking for the interior, but on both sides, you know, this is something that we're thinking about in a lot of different conversations, not just specific to one aspect or another. And I think that is really encouraging. And, you know, I think one of the things that also gives me hope is the fact that we're not trying to jump in with simple fixes and, you know, like paint over an issue that really deserves and warrants a lot of really deliberate thought and approach, because a lot of these things are going to be drivers for big systems change. Yeah. And that shouldn't happen overnight, because we need to make sure that what we're doing is really grounded in data, so that when we make those shifts, we understand why and we can communicate that why, and also monitor and see how things are doing too. Because again, like in kind of a bunch of different arenas, this is brand new territory for us. Structure fire, you know, is a little bit ahead of us, or maybe a lot ahead of us in different aspects too. And so we are reaching out to partners in a bunch of different arenas all over the board. I mean, not just within the fire environment, but first responders, Department of Homeland Security, the military, and just seeing how everybody tackles some of these bigger issues around exposures, hazards, behavioral health, physical health, to help inform what right looks like for us. And so it gives me hope again, too, that, you know, we might not ever have dipped our toe into this to the extent that we are and we will be, but other folks have. And that's also encouraging, so that we have other systems and programs to learn from to start us off on the right foot.
And I think I'll just add, too, you know, we're trying to create something that's different. Health and well-being is very personal. And so we're trying to be really mindful of that as we create programs, as we roll out services and resources, to really make sure that it's touching people and meeting people where they're at, and also evolving with the needs of the field, both from what we hear from the ground, but also what we learn from the science and the research, and really pulling that all together and making it personable and meaningful for this entire workforce, which feels daunting some days, but also incredibly exciting. I think, you know, this direction out of Congress is monumental, but it's amazing the priority that we've gotten from the agencies and that support as well to keep moving this forward and to create something that's going to be different for our future.
Yeah, and that was really well said, Kat. I think across the board, with all of the different aspects of firefighter health and well-being, one of the kind of key things that comes up quite a bit too is we can't create systems or tools or programs that never get utilized because they don't resonate with the field, or the field doesn't have trust with it, or it's not really what the field needs. You know, the field being a very diverse workforce. So that's a big part of our thought process around how do we kind of phase this and set it up so that we can learn and be nimble along the way, so that we are facing the impossible task of doing everything for everybody. But I think we also recognize we can't do everything for everybody. But what does right look like? What are the things that we, Interior and Forest Service, need to take on, and where are those things that maybe aren't in our jurisdiction, or maybe something that we can't best provide, and thinking through that in the long term about, you know, like, where is our lane, and what serves the community the best for us to own versus you know, leveraging partnerships or external relationships or entities as well. Because at the end of the day, yeah, we have to make sure it's trusted and it's going to be utilized, and that can't be just assumed that's going to happen naturally. We have to be really deliberate about setting things up so that we can ensure the highest likelihood of connection and success.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate ending on a hopeful note as well. And you know, it always impresses me, you know, talking to folks like you who are at these higher levels in our organizations, and to see how well you understand what's going on, you know, in this, the quandaries that people in the field face, and you know, and like you said, like, not trying to make this a Bondo fix, right? You actually want to do some real work that's gonna hopefully make things better for the long term. I really appreciate that, and I think we'll close on that. Really appreciate both of you, Erin Phelps, Kat DeBose, for coming and talking to me about this.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us, Eric. It's always a pleasure to talk about this topic that we're all very passionate about, too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Eric, Aaron, and Kat for all the information on this subject. I learned quite a bit from their perspectives, and I hope you did too. Firefighter health and well-being is such a big topic, and understanding the exposures we face and the potential steps we can take to mitigate hazards is important. Understanding the process to file a claim and ultimately receive benefits related to a presumptive illness is also critical. Aaron mentioned an RLS you may want to check out on our website related to firefighter health and the OWCP process. Visit our incident review database on our website at lessons.wildfire.gov and search for Federal Firefighter Presumptive Illness 2022. Consider completing the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health National Firefighter Registry to help gather data to inform future decisions related to firefighter cancer. Talk to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Wildfire Lessons Podcast. Be sure to subscribe, share, give us a review. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wildfire Lessons. Music provided by second generation smoke jumper Steve Baker, who always likes to keep one foot in the black. Thanks, Steve. Remember, we honor through learning.